You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is an absolute belter. Marcus Brigstocke has got a lot to say and I'm going to let him get on with it. Really excited about this one. Recorded live at the Gilded Balloon last year, this is Marcus Brigstocke.
Short walk and sitting down immediately.
Perfect. We should probably start with, what did you do to your leg?
Well, firstly, it's worth pointing out that Edinburgh is not a city, beautiful though it is, well set up for a person on crutches. This being a place where you can leave where you started to go where you're going and travel uphill, and then on the journey home, also travel uphill. City designed by Escher. Two of you. Fine, good. So what I've done to my leg specifically is I've ruptured my Achilles tendon and ripped all the muscles. Oh, that's lovely. People go, oh, yeah. People love a wound, don't they?
I don't know if that'll show up on the recording, but there was a lovely, the audience aren't mic'd, but there was a lovely little chorus of oohs there.
Yeah, I've ruptured, not broken, my Achilles tendon and ripped the muscles in the back of my leg.
And have you, as a result of that injury, cancelled or postponed any performances?
I am, Stu, the living embodiment of the word trooper.
Hey!
I am a soldier to my art. I am, yes. No, I haven't cancelled anything because fundamentally, actually, there are two things at work here. And the first is lovely and the second is cynical. The first is the Fringe and the Edinburgh Festival is the greatest thing in my year. This is brilliant. This is the biggest arts festival in the world. This is the third largest ticket-selling event in the world after the World Cup and the Olympics, which only happen every 4 years. This is every year, and the combined festivals sell more tickets than anything else. And most of the people here are paying for you to watch them. They're paying more per seat in the room for you to see them than you've paid to see them because they want to do the thing. And I am very privileged, genuinely privileged to be a part of that. So I'm very passionate about it. Added to which, the margins are sufficiently tight that to take a couple of shows off would mean that I'd lose an absolute fortune.
Fair it is.
So,
okay, and not only are you appearing at your show still, but you're also at the end of it. And I mean, we mentioned this, I don't want to sort of spoiler it, but certainly in the show I saw, you danced.
Yes, I did.
Go-go style.
Big time.
Yeah,
big time.
At the end of the show. Well, you were completely committed to it. And as I tweeted at the time, it was an incredibly unself-conscious moment. It was very revealing.
Well, I'm very pleased that it seemed unselfconscious because I feel very self-conscious whilst doing it. Well, particularly because this year's show is actually different. It's strange that we should be having this discussion this year because the show that I'm doing is storytelling. It's just stuff from my life. I've made a huge shift just to try something different. And the end of the show is a true story about the fact that I used to be a podium dancer. There's no need for a sort of snort of derision like that. More than half a lifetime ago, I was genuinely employed as a podium dancer. And so I discussed this in the show and at the same time held down a job on an oil rig. All right. I wasn't ever engaged as a dancer on an oil rig. They don't have those yet. But it's true. And so I discussed this. And then at the end of the show, I set up this thing where I went, obviously, that was half a lifetime ago. I couldn't possibly dance like that now, could I? And the audience went, hooray, brilliant, dance, 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 like this, which I did. And then the gag thing of sort of, no, I can't dance like that anymore, was proved exactly right during the second show when this injury took place.
And so you injured yourself dancing?
That was doing it. Okay. Yes, the audience thought it was utterly brilliant. They love a wound. And they grabbed the microphone stand and went, you've been lovely. I think I've broken my leg. And hopped out of the room and people were like, yeah, fantastic. Okay. So
what prompted the change then? I mean, you're known, I guess, to most people here and most people listening at home as a political comedian. So why?
Mr. Crosspants.
Yeah.
Yes. Mostly because I wrote a show last year called The Briggs Society, which was looking at austerity and coalition politics and what has happened since the coalition government took over in the UK. And I'm a slow reactor, actually, and somewhat less cynical than I think some people would credit me with, in that I think a coalition is a terrific thing because I think it much more closely reflects how we actually live our lives. Everything is a coalition. You make arrangements with your friends and your family and your loved ones to achieve the things you want to achieve. And you can't do everything that you want to do. And that's good. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this particular coalition seems to have been one party going, yeah, go on then, while the others more or less do exactly what they want. But anyway, I was slow to react. And so I hadn't written a political show since this very significant change. Since 1997, we've been under a Labour administration. And so I wrote the most political show I've ever done, and I toured 100 dates. And by the time that was over, I had no interest left in discussing what this government were doing. Doing a topical show every day, but it isn't political. It isn't really satirical in the same way. So I was just done with it, but I didn't want to miss the fringe. And as it turns out, like, I've always been a bit allergic to comedians who only talk about themselves. I think, really, can you not find a more interesting subject than that, Russell Brand? Can you not? Well, do you know, Russell, for me, I'd count myself a fan, but only of about 15% of his output, which is when he's talking about anything other than Russell Brand. Mm-hmm. He is brilliant. Mm-hmm. His way with words is breathtaking, stunning. I really, really admire him. Unfortunately, the most interesting thing, inevitably, in Russell's life is Russell. And so I've been a bit allergic to comics who talk about themselves, but I thought, as it goes, a story where I went from being a 24-stone goth, I was 5'9" at the time, 24-stone goth, and in under 2 years, I weighed 11 stone. I worked on an oil rig, and I was holding down a part-time job as a podium dancer. As stories go, it's not too shabby, really.
But have you enjoyed talking about yourself? Have you felt like, oh, I see why Russell does it? This is great.
Oh, totally. It's fantastic. What you do, right, in terms of, this will be very short in terms of the content of this podcast. What you do is you do stuff, and then you tell people.
Yeah.
That's it. That's how you write comedy. Do stuff. And then tell them, and that's it. And leave out the bits that are just information. Try and only tell them the bits that are funny. That's it. That's the process. Okay. So it's been...
And with regard to that process, even that kind of light treatment of that idea, within that, there is the issue of like how much of the stuff that you say in your show, how much of the storytelling stuff is true. I mean, I get the sense it's 100%.
Every word is true.
And you don't change timing or people's perspectives or anything like that. No. It's a reportage.
No, it is. In this instance, it's a reportage. You leave out information. So there's a big story, a long story that I tell in the first part of the show because it happened very recently and actually is still happening now as we speak. I have been suffering a low level of testicular discomfort for nearly 2 years now. But it was about 18 months before I thought, as a bloke, you know, you get to about 18 months and you go, well, that's not going away on its own, is it? I think we can say a looser trouser is not going to take care of that. And then you begin to think, well, I don't know what it is. I put it down to UKIP. I thought, well, because it coincides almost exactly with the significant political rise of UKIP as a force in Britain, that my nuts have been aching. And predominantly the left one, which is what made me think it might be political. So there's a story there of sort of self-examination of my plums, and then going to a doctor, and then ending up having a scan done by a parent at my child's school, which is very unexpected. I walked in and the man doing the scan. And so, you know, things lined themselves up in a way that I went, right, well, I'll say all of this and leave out all the stuff that isn't, you know, that isn't funny. So it's been lovely. I will return to satirical, ranty based stuff because that's also what I like, but I will also, I hope, come back to more of what I'm doing this year, because it's been despite the leg thing, it's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed myself this year.
Sure.
And I'm a bit less stressed.
Do you think it's given you a different perspective on comedians who talk about themselves, or do you consider that you've sort of briefly taken a holiday in being that self-involved?
I suppose I've never actually, I mean, I was to say I'm allergic to comedians that do that. I'm not really. I love what a lot of them do. It just, I don't think it's the most interesting version of them very often. So whether it's changed my view of them or not, I don't know.
Because you're someone who I think of, I think I first met you at the Altitude Festival, which you set up with Andrew Maxwell, was it? You set it up together. And Andrew was on this show a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
He's got a very, I mean, he kind of marries the two. He's this sort of stories, you know, as if he's a guy in the pub telling stories. And there's also a lot of sort of political ideas in there as well. But you are someone that I kind of see socially hanging out with more of the kind of journeyman. Do you know who I mean? The sort of comedians who are more like, and I've mentioned it, I haven't quite got further than, in the street performing world, we'd call them buscarados, the kind of people who walk around in their costume the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a parallel there with, although there isn't a costume, there are stand-up comedians who walk around in their character all the time, some of whom are your friends.
Yes, yes.
So you don't think they're
I'm less like that, I think. Yeah. I think of myself as less like that.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, I mean, the conversations that I have with people, for example, the people I follow on Twitter and the people that I sit about with, the comics that I sit about with, I don't consciously try to steer the conversation in the direction of politics, but it's the thing that interests me the most by a distance. Sure. Not just party political stuff, but social politics. I always want to know what people think, including people whose opinions are very different from my own, and including people who I think are either lying or thick or stupid or misinformed or, you know, I'm probably more interested in what they have to say than anyone else. Because you're like, wow, how do you, my God, really? You wake up in the morning and you know how to read, don't you? And you can log onto a computer and you can open a book and everything, and you don't think climate change is a thing.
Sure.
Oh my God. What an incredible life you lead.
What do you think it is in your past, in your upbringing maybe, that drove you or that drives you to have that sort of inquiring attitude?
Well, I suppose the strongest likelihood is that I wasted the amazing opportunities afforded to me. I went to boarding school when I was 7. Okay. Which is to some people quite shocking. It wasn't to me, it was perfectly normal. Everyone I knew who was 7 did the same thing. On your 7th birthday, your parents looked at you and went, well, I think that's enough of that. And off you went. And, you know, I met my parents again in my early 20s. Turns out they're absolutely delightful. lovely people. It's very hard to work out which ones are family, but, you know. And I squandered all of that because I had some issues, which is in part what I'm talking about at this year's show. Mm-hmm. I got sort of sidetracked by addictions, predominantly to food and then later to alcohol and drugs and all the rest of it. And so I reached the age of 19 and I had a GCSE and nothing else, just the one in woodwork. So the most useful GCSE of all. But I knew I sort of knew I wasn't thick, you know, because I read for pleasure, but I wasn't very interested in the rest of it. So I think what happened is when I then went back to sort of researching stuff and really asking questions about stuff on my own terms, I began to find it genuinely fascinating. And I remember the first time I went to the Hay on Wye Literary Festival, and I was like, I had no idea these existed, where people get together in a field and exchange really complicated ideas. And for those struggling to keep up, there are various sort of strata of people to explain the information in simpler and simpler ways,
sure,
further down the chain. And then and somewhere in that chain I sit going, right, I get it now. And then I, in stand-up, sort of try and explain it in simple ways that are accessible and comedically pleasing, you know. So self-education has become something that I really genuinely enjoy, having hated school. So maybe it's that. Maybe that the curiosity comes from there.
Is that, because you're not just someone who participates in the field of education, self-education, politics. You're yet, hey on why. I can sort of imagine you being carried around it because you're kind of the king of those things. You produce an incredible amount of material on the radio.
Yeah.
You're a very well-known and very popular cultural commentator.
And unpopular.
Yeah, so
that's
sure.
an important part of this, apparently, which oddly my delicate ego finds difficult to cope with, even though I know perfectly well that the Daily Telegraph are likely, broadly speaking, to absolutely hate what I broadcast. I still found it immensely hurtful when they did a big sort of attack piece saying how truly dreadful I was. It was like, oh no. And it really, really bothers me, which is sort of a bit pathetic. It's also probably...
Well, is it pathetic if they're sort of, if a broadsheet newspaper is having a big personal go at you?
Well, it's pathetic in as much as some very sweet people defended me and said, it's very easy for the critics. But I'm a critic. I'm not a critic of artistic endeavours for the most part. I'm sniffy about what Russell Brand and Frankie Boyle... What a waste of Frankie Boyle. Can you imagine if he used those powers for good?
Yeah.
Oh, just... He's a genius, Frankie. If I had his way with words, if I could boil things down to in the way that he can, and that I use the word boil advisedly, if I could boil things down like that, I'd just be delighted. And his targets are these... people who fully don't deserve it. It kind of breaks my heart. Anyway, but I am a critic and I gob off about things, and it's perfectly reasonable for people who disagree with me to go for me. So it is a bit pathetic of me to sort of go, well, that wasn't very fair. And I just have to sort of keep the ego in check.
Do you think that in your material you go for people as well?
I do, although I have tried and it's difficult to avoid the more personal end of things. If I think someone's lying, climate change is a big one for me, right? And I happen to know that a lot of the people who say that it isn't happening are simply lying. They haven't really convinced themselves it isn't happening. They're just lying. I will go
because they're in the employ of,
because they know, because they know perfectly well, because they're not thick and the information's out there, and you have to go to a very small circle of information that says no it isn't, no it isn't, no it isn't, no it isn't. And it's funded by, you know, they will say, you know, your sort of Dominic Lawson's and stuff will say, well, no, it isn't funded by the oil companies. Well, it is. It is. And it keeps coming out that it is. And the Koch brothers or Koch brothers or whatever, Koch, I think we'll stick with. So there you go. There's a personal attack based on a very childish thing. But the Koch brothers have funded a great deal of anti-climate science stuff. And they're oilmen, amongst other things that they do. And so I sort of think, no, I will. I'm going to go for you personally because you're lying, and that's dangerous and it matters. But I've tried much more in the last sort of 4 or 5 years to not go for people on a very personal level.
Is that because you've experienced people going for you and feel like you need to modify that?
It may be. I'd like to think it's more just I've got a little bit older and realised, oh, that's not really good enough, is it? You can do better than that.
Okay.
I mean, I did, you know, in the last show, I talked about Gideon Osborne, not George. Gideon changed his name from Gideon to George because he felt Gideon might make him seem somehow elitist and posh and out of touch, failing to spot he has a wooden face and lying, bulging eyes. So there's
another personal attack.
Well, that is a personal attack, exactly. Well, I don't know. Interesting. I don't know if you know about Osborne's family, but his father, Geppetto, said, you see, so I don't mind that because Osborne is in a place where what he thinks and who he is and where he's come from matters. But I then explained that I was at school with George Osborne, not literally, but I know people who were, and I was at the next school over because those are the places I inhabited. And so I know what is wrong with those people. Mm-hmm. Because they should be working for Foxton's estate agents rather than running the country. One or two of them in government is very good. It's important because they have a lot to offer. When it's most of them, we're screwed. And so I know those people, and so I don't mind going for them a bit, and it's also why the Telegraph then go for me, because I am a traitor.
And because, and presumably because they consider you an important target because you've got cultural influence.
I'm one of theirs. I ought to be one of theirs. I shouldn't be kicking up such a stink about this sort of thing because I have a very comfortable lifestyle. Why on earth should I bother kicking up a stink about this sort of thing? I went to the same schools as those
and
people.
And is that a criticism that's ever levelled at you by audiences?
No, is not it, is really, it, is because it hard heckles, for you to... heckles are never that complicated, really.
Sure.
No, I mean, they sort of... It would sort of be more interesting if they were, you know.
Yeah.
But I do, like most comedians do, Bill Bailey's the best example of this, I expose my vulnerabilities before anyone else can get to them.
Sure.
I was lucky enough to be to support Bill Bailey very early on in my career. And what happens is you go out and you do 20 minutes to an audience that are sitting there going, I wish Bill Bailey was on. And you sort of want to go, so do I. It's why I'm here. But after sort of five or six shows, you've seen their show and you'd go home because why would you stay? I stayed for every one of Bill's shows and watched. And it was mostly the same every night because Bill is a master craftsman. Mm-hmm. He does a brilliant thing. And I hope he doesn't mind me giving it away. It comes on beginning. Lovely to be in Woking. So anyway, Meatloaf regional winner, and makes it look like he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah,
and then he picks up a guitar.
Yeah.
And plays brilliantly and sings brilliantly with very complicated ideas that delight the audience. And they go, but he doesn't know what he's doing. And now he's done that. And sure. And you go, right. And it's a very neat little trick. I, for years, wore a corduroy suit on stage as a stand-up. It became my trademark. My DVD is called Planet Corduroy and can be found in many a bargain bin.
And free on YouTube.
And free on YouTube entirely, yes. And I wore a corduroy suit because, I happened to have one and I went on in it one day and I realised it lowered my status.
Okay.
In a brilliant way.
Yes.
I went on and the audience went, there's no way this bloke makes me laugh. He's a supply teacher who's wandered on at the wrong event.
Sure.
And it lowered everyone's expectations. And then you come out with something and they go, I didn't expect that. This guy's awesome.
Okay.
Right? And it's sort of a trick. I don't do the corduroy thing anymore because things have changed. And, you know, but, and also because the suits became so smelly. They're capable of doing,
what other things have
doing
changed
my show
when,
without
when,
me.
When you say things have changed.
Well, things have changed because now most audiences, not all, but most know who I am when I come on stage. So there isn't a trick. So now it's the opposite. Now it's probably more that I confirm a few things about myself when I come on rather than pretending that anything's particularly different. You know, so people think of me as being posh because I am and opinionated because I am. And so I will walk on stage somewhere and go, well, isn't it nice to be here? I love what you've done with it. And it sort of confirms what people think, and then sure. I unpick that and blah blah blah. So you
okay,
know, they're kind of tricks to get a gig going, you know.
Sure,
and they work.
So this is Marcus. Rarely have I wanted a conversation to continue quite as much as I did this one. He's so passionate, so informed, so opinionated, really inspiring, and his awareness and acceptance of his own flaws is really engaging too. It's the last time I can plug this now. I'm interviewing Jared Christmas for a live ComCom pod at 5:30 p.m. at Firebug in Leicester on Sunday the 16th of Feb, and later that night at 8 p.m. at Handsome Hall, I'll be previewing my new hour, comedy-festival.co.uk, for details and tickets on those and links to the Handsome Hall one. I think that's pay-what-you-want.info for tickets if you want to pay something in advance and secure a seat. Thanks for all your donations to the show. They really make a difference to me and all my machinations for new projects and new ways to pick people's brains. Thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. If I was treating you like a street show crowd in the olden days, I'd be sure to say that this is what I do for a living. I mean, we all know that I'm working hard as a comic, so that's not really the case. But what I will say is that every time you make a donation to support the show, as well as beginning to cover me on the Edinburgh run you're listening to now and making me more inclined to take risks on similar projects in the future and helping me buy better equipment and pay people who help me, it also, I realised this the other day, it also makes me want to work harder. It's starting to feel like one big, long, slow street show, and that pleases me no end, so thank you all again. As usual, if you'd like to donate anything from 5 to 50 quid or more, it's up to you. There's no obligation. Just go to the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com. And if you can't support me with money or you don't want to, that's fine. You don't owe me. You can help me out by rating the show on iTunes, subscribing to the ComCom Pod YouTube channel, and or sharing this podcast or the video with a friend. Thank you very much. That was a big old speech. Thanks for staying with me. Now, let's get back to the brilliant Marcus Brigstock.
I want to talk a lot more about some of the political stuff. I've got there's lots to talk about there, but just while we're on the subject of that as a sort of a strategy to win over an audience or a strategy to unlock an audience, that thing we were talking about before, which is I just want to briefly kind of explore that, which is that when I met you years ago, or maybe a couple of times, I'd known you for a couple of years, in the French Alps at this comedy festival you created, I overheard you saying to someone else, oh, stand-up comedy, that's just... And then you proceeded to very casually give an incredibly good example of how to take an idea, unpack it, pull all the funny out, repackage it, and then deliver it on stage. And I remember thinking, I'm very much the new boy here. I'm going to look like a total dork if I obviously make a note of that. So I didn't make a note. I forgot it. And I thought, I've been saving this
I wish I'd made a note of it at the time. Well, it depends. With politics, which is mostly what I do, I suppose if there's an approach to it, it's say what it is, and then say and then give away the misconception about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whatever it may be, or you know, you could do something provocative and talk about climate change, which you know is a divisive issue. It splits people up, doesn't it, between those who think it isn't happening and people who read. And well, it's very difficult, isn't it, for the hard of thinking who are apparently still allowed a voice. And so you sort of confirm yourself into a position. And then a lot of the stuff that I do with complicated political ideas is take it into a stupid metaphor. Right. So I'm just trying to think of a good example. Okay, well, I have a thing at the moment about how Greece ended up in the euro. Mm-hmm. This was in the Briggs Society show. And I thought, well, Greece should never have been in the euro. Goldman Sachs got Greece in. There were entry criteria to join the euro, which Greece didn't meet. They had too much sovereign debt. They should never have been made a member, but it was inconvenient for everybody and blah, blah, blah. It's the most boring thing in the world. But what is Greece? Well, they want to get into a thing that has everybody else in it. So then they're like a kid outside a nightclub with the wrong shoes on.
Okay.
And then you've got an image there. And then you're like, okay, well, who runs the nightclub? So the Greeks are outside and France are on the door. And France say, no, you cannot come in here, shitty Greece. Look at you. Huh? You are too young. You have too much sovereign debt. You're wearing the wrong shoes. Look, you have curly slippers on. Get out of here. So now you have an image. The Greek guy who can't get in because he's got curly slippers on. And then Goldman Sachs give them fake ID. They're the ones selling the fake ID, which is what they did. And then Greece sneak in. And the Greeks are inside the club now, and they're excited. They're like, woo! That's when they realize the club has a German DJ. That's when shit gets scary for Greece because the music is too fast for them. And then I do a beatbox and I do a German MC going, yeah, das ist mein Eurohaus. And the Greeks going, please slow the music down. Don't you have any Nanimous Kouri or Demis Roussos? So explaining things just like you do to a child through metaphor and creating, building an image is the most fun way for me of working. Mm. I also do battering ram comedy, which is take the idea and just kick off on it and just blast your way through. And I made a program with Rufus Hound, really fun, argumental, and just loved it. And it genuinely, people pretend to be a bit blasé when series come to an end, broke my heart when they killed that show, and kill it they did. I loved it. And Rufus is deft, and he can leap from subject to subject and idea, and he's charming, and he'll stand up and a crowd will just go, wherever the Pied Piper leads, we will follow.
Okay.
Whereas I would sit there and I would take the issue very seriously and I would smash at it with great big hands and get my laughs, you know. But it was just, it really illustrated to me two very different approaches to creating comedy.
And when you're actually creating those, are you someone that sits and writes them? Are you doing spider diagrams and stuff like that? What's your notebook look like? What's your writing process?
A mess, and full of keywords. So the process specifically is have an idea and then do it on stage. Okay. Do it. The idea
before any writing.
No, have the idea, make some notes, flesh it out, think about it, give yourself a start point and an end point and a thing to achieve during the thing. And
well, then, what do you mean by a thing to achieve?
Well, a thing to achieve would be, well, what is it? Is it a political thing? So do you want to prove the point that, okay, that you're making? Or do you want to reach, for example, with the Greek economic situation, get yourself into a metaphor somehow, you know? Okay. So it might be as vague as that, or I may have an idea. And then go out and do it in front of an audience. And I've never found a suitably humble description for this process, but there is a thing that I think genuinely exists that I call super brain,
okay,
which is comic on stage with mic in hand in a gig situation is capable of thinking of things that you cannot think of anywhere else.
Absolutely.
And the delight for me is striking on an idea that makes me laugh in the moment, mm-hmm, and I go brilliant, and I enjoy it as much as the audience enjoys it, sometimes more, okay, in that moment, because I go, I had no idea that joke was coming either, and then bam, there, sure, it is. And often that's the perfect version of the joke. And the only person I have met who's capable of thinking like that, seemingly under no pressure, is Frank Skinner. Frank,
okay,
Frank thinks in jokes. He thinks in complete crafted jokes, and I do not know how he achieves it, because it's not like he's so intelligent you can't have a chat with him.
Yeah,
but something's happening in Frank Skinner's brain where he can speak in whole, fully formed jokes, and it's breathtaking to be around.
Okay,
very jealous of Frank Skinner.
Sure,
whilst not particularly wishing to be that kind of comic, but I see it and go, wow.
Do you think that? Would you like to see Frank Skinner doing more political stuff?
No, I don't. The fact that I've ended up doing political stuff hasn't really led me to go, oh, well, you're wasting your time, because all you, okay, talk about, Ross Noble, is swans riding around on the back of a monkey.
Yeah.
Because I love what those people do, and the comedy I admire the most is not the comedy like my own. The stuff that I enjoy is different. Bill Bailey, Ross Noble, you know, lots and lots of, I mean, the Muppets probably have made me laugh more than anything else in my life. I still watch the old Muppet shows and I still honk like a goose with laughter, mm-hmm, at how brilliant they are and anarchic and actually political in their way. But I don't, you know, I liked Bill Hicks because we're contractually bound as comedians to like Bill Hicks. And then comes the day when you realize the hypocrisy in some of what he did and you go, oh no. But no, I don't. It doesn't bother me,
okay,
if someone like Frank isn't. It does with Frankie Boyle, as I said, because Frankie has a stunning ability to sharpen his jokes and hit targets and destroy them. He's brilliant at it. They just,
yeah. His Twitter bio gives his occupation. It's just one word. It says sniper.
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, well, unfortunately, that to me would be more evidence of the ruination of Frankie, which is that somebody somewhere convinced him that he's the most dangerous man on earth.
Mm.
And actually, what he is an utterly brilliant and very charming man. He's a really
lovely guy. Yeah.
Utterly brilliant comedian. Really, truly, genuinely brilliant. And I suspect the producer on Mock the Week was largely involved in this thing of going, go on, Frankie, go on. There's a disabled kid. There's someone who's been raped. Go get him, Buster. Mm. I'm like, those are not the people for me that I want to see those Exocet missile jokes destroy. I want to see them go after the people who cause pain rather than the people who are in pain. That's a great thing. It's glib, but someone said to me the function of satire is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Mm.
And I do that. I do that when I'm writing. If I write a new show, I'll often scribble that at the top of the page. And then at the end, you go, oh, no, well, I can't have that one then.
Okay.
That's cheating.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you feel a responsibility then to try to make do you feel like, yeah, you're making a difference? Do you feel you're contributing to changing people's minds?
No, definitely no. I mean, I do really think that I do, but no, not genuinely. I mean, I sort of, while I'm doing it, I go, yeah, yeah. We're going to change the world. Come on. And then afterwards, it's important to disassociate yourself from the idea that what you've done is anything other than tell jokes to people. It is just that. It just happens to be the subjects on which I am most passionate are the ones, as you'd understand, that I'm most that I find it easiest to be funny about because I'm passionate about them. And so, and what happened for me was I started off and I was a really good club comic, and I feel all right about saying that, ego aside, because it was such a different version of me. I was very good at copying voices and styles and tones that I'd seen on television or anywhere else. And so I became a headliner at Jonglers and stuff, you know, and I'd headline and I'd encore their shows. And I just remember after a while, I'd come off stage having encored and stormed it and, you know, blah, 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 standing ovations and all the loveliness. And I just felt like crap. I was like, what's, I don't understand. Why don't I feel great? What's going on? And it wasn't just kind of, I wish I was further up the career ladder. It was just that I wasn't talking about anything that I minded about. Mm. So everything sort of thing. And as luck would have it, the Iraq war came along and lucky me, the Iraq war came along and I suddenly found that I did care desperately about that. And I felt terribly betrayed because it was very exciting. I was at university when Labour came into power in 97 and I was like, wow, this is a thing. This is a real thing. Here we go. Mm. And I felt very betrayed. And I was at odds with audiences very often. Once the war began, there was this very odd attitude that we ought to support the troops, whereas my opinion was, well, fine, but which troops? Ours or theirs? Both? Neither in my case. I didn't want there to be a war, so why would I support either troops? I didn't want anybody to hurt anybody else in a very naive kind of way, but I didn't support our troops killing their troops any more or less than I supported theirs killing ours. No one should have been involved in that particular conflict in that way. Not unless everything else in terms of oil imports, weapon sales and all the rest of it had changed first. Then if there's a dictator out there and all of those other things are lined up very neatly, then I would support a war. But otherwise, no. So I was very much at odds with audiences who went, once you go in, you get behind the boys. And I was like, nope, not me. Sorry. And it changed. It really changed everything I did in comedy. And I was like, no, I'm not going to just write stuff that pleases the audience that I'm in front of. As it happens, once you make that decision, the audience that comes to see you tend largely to be people who agree with you. So yes, it closes itself back
yes
up.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. That's kind of an issue that, like, I've noticed on some of your Radio 4 stuff, you affect this kind of, not a disdain, but a sort of a poking fun at the cozy Radio 4 audiences. And they're the people you're their brightest star, you know.
Well, yes, because the accusations of a liberal elite are absolutely right. I mean, I feel awkward saying this, but there is a liberal elite, and I'm part of it, and it doesn't reflect the view of most people in the UK. But I'm still glad that there is a liberal elite because I'm part of it. And I don't wish necessarily to reflect the views of everybody living in the UK because our media isn't good enough. I'm not saying those people are thick. I'm not saying they're not even working hard enough to find out the truth or whatever. I'm saying it's too difficult. Most people don't have time. I lead a disgustingly comfortable lifestyle. I can spend a few days reading the paper, watching the telly, channel hopping and being on Twitter and say I've done an excellent fortnight of research. And that's fine. But most people's lives are not like that. Most people were not born with the sort of privilege that I have and have the time available to them and get paid just to gob off on subjects. Most people are busy actually getting things done. So there is a liberal elite, and I think it's important to whatever degree I dare to mock it, you know, and be honest about it.
Whilst recognising your own place in it.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, you know, full of contradictions, but and hypocrisy. But I'm a shit environmentalist. Oh my God, for someone who knows as much about climate change as me, I don't know if I love a bit of South American beef. Oh, have you tried it? Argentinian beef is sensational, and yet here we are in Scotland. I mean, there's excellent beef here, but I tell you what, if you offered me an Argy steak now, I'd struggle to turn it down.
And that is this you making sure that you've got one in it yourself before anyone else can.
Somewhat, yeah. Although I didn't beat them to it on most of that. There are websites that keep a track of places I've been on holiday.
Okay.
Because there is no argument about man-made climate change. So instead they have to say, ah, well, the people telling you about it still go on holiday. Like, yeah, I do. I try not to, and I offset my flights and things like that. But it's still rubbish.
I wanted to talk about a particular piece of material that you'd done, which I thought really encapsulated how you managed to get difficult messages across in a way that still means you can have a career as a comedian. Because as you're saying, when you started, I mean, presumably, did you then start doing anti-Iraq war stuff at Jonglers? Did you start doing those gigs? And they went horribly badly.
Yeah, I got booed off a lot. That led to an extraordinary thing, which was that I was at the Glee Club in Birmingham. It's a great place to gig. Wonderful club. Mm. Birmingham's a wonderful city to gig in because they don't suffer from the blight of regional pride, which I really, really like.
There's a lovely pause there while everyone tries to work out if you're slagging it off.
Well, I sort of am, but it is also what genuinely endears me to Birmingham, because you go on there and go, hello, what's it like here? And they go, it's a bit shit, but we like it.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, you know, I really like that attitude. I think Birmingham's a great place. However, I was very much at odds with that audience. And a man hated me so much, he took off his prosthetic leg and threw it at me. I was kicked from over 15 feet away by a man who hated me enough to give up 50% of his means of getting home. That's a heckle, my friend. That's how you get it done.
And that again, which you talk about in your show.
I do, yeah.
That took place during you trying to do that difficult material.
That was around the time of the Iraq war, and it was part of the reason why I was at odds with that audience. Yeah, yeah.
So, but you have learned to, and it's not just a case of changing your audience, but you have learned to, package is maybe the wrong word, but to write in such a way that you can communicate ideas and still make them palatable. And the piece of material I wanted to talk about was the, it's on your Corduroy Planet DVD,
yeah.
And it's the Mrs. Brigstock World Rape Tour clip,
yes.
Which the name of which obviously sounds very, it needs some explanation. Yeah.
It doesn't it?
Yeah, doesn't it? Which is that you were having a conversation with, no, it's rather, it's about your neighbour who blocked your extension. Well, if you'd like to sort of
describe essentially what happened. So there's a lot of discussion now about rape jokes, and it's interesting because I've done an extended routine about rape in which, in essence, I do trivialise the crime of rape, but in response to a specific event, which I hope makes sense of it. I was talking with my next door neighbour who had blocked an extension that I had planned, and that was really, for a middle class boy, the source of the greatest tension between us. However, he also was fervently anti-immigration and was willing to put about the sorts of lies you'll find in a great many of the tabloids like the Mail and the Express and stuff. And we were talking about immigration, and I said, I think we should throw the doors open, the more the merrier. And he did the sort of nervous giggle of a man very uncomfortable with the conversation, and we pressed it a bit, and then he said, yes, you're probably right, until one of them rapes your wife. And I was like, wow. Do you honestly believe that people are coming here hanging onto the bottoms of refrigerated lorries just in order to rape my wife? I mean, that's a hell of a commitment. And so it went on. And then I imagined a way in which I could help immigrants by taking my wife to Gatwick so that people could just fly here, rape her, and then fly home again without having to clear customs, which is, you know. And then I thought, well, that's not really ambitious enough. What we ought to do really is take it right to them. And so it went on, and I built a horrific image. But the point was to grow out a disgusting idea that he could suggest and get away with. And the papers do it, and other people do it. They can make a truly disgusting notion and say, well, obviously, I mean, blah, 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 I didn't mean, da, da, da. And so what I did in that instance is grow it out into the most grotesque, but also a straight line from his starting point through to, well, if that is why people are coming here, then let's do this.
Take that premise, find the illogic in it, and then
No, exactly. So it was ultimately not even about the perpetrators of the horrific crime of rape, and for the hundreds now of young comics for whom rape is the punchline to fucking everything. I wish they'd pack it in, or at least do some reading and research it or something, you know. It wasn't even a response to the perpetrators of rape. It was a response to a casual attitude to that kind of bigotry. And, you know, and we've seen this week with the Bongo Land thing from UKIP, you know.
Sure. And what really impressed me, on top of that as a line of argument, but in the writing of it, because it's framed by... it's absolutely framed and repeatedly, the Telegraph polls, if you like, throughout it are, this guy blocked my extension, that's why I hate him.
Yeah.
So you were able to play up your own patheticness for wanting to have a go at him at the same time. So you managed to couch what was an incredibly difficult logic. You know, just following the logic of that is kind of arguably not that funny, or a bit too painful.
Yeah, exactly. In the construction of it, it's too big, it's too much, and it's too grotesque. And if you keep bringing it back to, I am a small and petty man, and end it with this absolutely horrific thing. I think the final image was something to do with it wasn't a genocide, but it was something where people, you know, someone's wife and family and children had been killed and his mud hut had been bulldozed. And he said, but at least I have Mrs. Brigstock to rip. And it was monstrous. And it was so disgusting deliberately. And then I went, plus he blocked my extension. And it was a release.
Yes.
For the audience and for me as well, because how do you end anything like that?
Sure.
So, you know,
presumably in the writing, in the creation of that routine, though, there were times when you tried to do that routine and it didn't work. Were there problems? Were there times when? So, I mean, that was a struggle to get that piece of material together.
That's a foxy bit of material.
To
put together, because how do you preview a version of it that doesn't work?
Absolutely.
It's too much. And the answer is, you just do it. You just have to do it. And then you have to sort of say to an audience beforehand, look, I hope we understand each other here, that this previewing process is me making mistakes. Mm. When I previewed God Collar, the show I did about atheism and theology and my problems with atheism, the ways in which it's left me feeling a bit alone and scared and all the rest of it, and also the sort of feeling that as much as I am definitely an atheist, bandwagons rarely have careful enough drivers. And I felt that I was being bounced along on a busy bandwagon with Richard Dawkins somewhere near the front of it, and felt very uncomfortable. But the early versions of that were disgusting in terms of the carelessness with which I trampled over other people's belief systems. And I had people leaving in tears and all sorts of things, and they were quite justified. And then I refined it. And then there was nothing in the final version of the God Collar show that I did that I felt in any way uncomfortable about, including trampling over people's belief systems, but carefully, and having researched precisely where I wanted my foot to fall. And I felt okay about that. And you know, what I loved from doing that show, in particular, very specifically, was, you know, I had a routine in there about the Islamists' response to portraits of the Prophet Muhammad and them going nuts. And then I said, you know, I've always wanted to create one of those magic eye pictures of the Prophet Muhammad so that only really patient Muslims will want to kill me. I still love it as an image. And then I had one of them staring at it for ages and then going, oh, this is blasphemy, look. And he shows it to his friend and his friend stares at it for ages. And then there's an argument over whether it's Muhammad or a dolphin.
Sure. Yeah.
And I feel perfectly comfortable in having that discussion, because I think that for a non-Muslim to paint a picture of the Prophet Muhammad is entirely, those are not my rules. I'm not a Muslim. Mm. So I feel perfectly okay about that. But what I really liked about it was that several Muslims came to see the show and wrote to me. Mm-hmm. They wrote to me. On Twitter, some of them, on email, and one of them, a letter written on a piece of paper in the old-fashioned way, and said, came to your show, really enjoyed most of it, really didn't like that bit, just so I'd let you know, because that's how most Muslims are, just like most Christians are. And they'll go, I didn't like that. And then they get on with their day. They're not all bonkers. Mm. Some of them are, but not all. And so, you know, that was an interesting thing. But I needed in the early versions of that, of the horrible, horrible rape routine, and the early versions of talking about theology and talking about the parts of religious belief that truly disgust me, to bounce off the walls and get it wrong. And it's where, actually, I was very lucky as a new comic. I was still at Bristol University and I had a huge amount of latitude down there to put shows on in front of students and be rubbish. I was crap. And I bounced off the walls and I made lots and lots of mistakes. And when I turned up in London to do shows in the Comedy Store and the Comedy Caff and the Ha Bloody Ha, who gave me all my first gigs, I showed up and I was introduced as a brand new newcomer. And they went, here's this new guy from Bristol or something. And I went on stage and I was really good
the
for
old,
5 minutes.
The old non-London-based switcheroo.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I went on stage and they were like, holy shit, this guy works miracles. And then they booked me for 10 minutes and went, no, he doesn't. Not yet. Not yet.
Okay. So we've got about 5 or 10 minutes left. If anyone would like to ask a question, then if you ask it through me, that's fab, and I'll repeat it for the recording. So the first question is, the change from your commercial clubs material to wanting to say something, was that an overnight change? Did you totally change your set or did you try to drop things in? How did that work?
It was fast. It was a very fast change. And the reason it was fast is the other stuff stopped working. When it was put alongside stuff with intent and research, the other stuff stopped working. It was too inconsequential. And so I ended up very quickly with an entire 20-minute and then 30-minute and then 40-minute and then hour-long set, which was political, because once I'd made that shift, the more, I don't want to say banal, because I don't think it was really. Comedy's comedy and it's all valuable if it makes an audience laugh. You know, I would say that some things are beyond the pale for my taste, but I wouldn't see them banned. But, you know, it's all valid. But the more banal end of things stopped working alongside the stuff that had intent. Mm. And I lost interest in it. It was quick. It was within 6 months. Interestingly, I did carry on at Jonglers. And my set at Jonglers was about the European Union and European integration and whether or not we should join. And I used to take a straw poll of audience members at Jonglers as to whether or not they had read the European Constitution. I'd ask first, who thinks we should be given a referendum on the European Constitution? And most rooms, because of the amount of information available, would go, ask us questions. And then I'd go, right, keep your hand up if you've read it. And so I went on from there about, you know, the way in which we're asked to make decisions. And here we are in Scotland. They're being asked to make a very important decision without knowing how much of the oil you'll keep and how much of the debt. That's all you need to know. How can you answer that question without having fixed answers to those questions? An entire waste of time, but not a waste of time asking the Scottish people whether they want independence. See, I can't leave it alone. It's like a scam. But it was swift. But I did carry on and I was political. And the comics who tell you that it's impossible to do that sort of stuff at Jonglers are lying. What happened at Jonglers was, unfortunately, it was a combination of things. It was they opened too many clubs and there were not enough compares of sufficient quality. Comparing a show is much, much harder than it looks and takes a great deal more skill than opening, middling or closing. And a good compere will steer an evening very carefully and quite brilliantly. And there's only a few people who can really do that very well. So the compares got crap and they went for the lowest common denominator. And we went in under a year from compares who knew what they were doing to people going on going, that shirt's a bit gay. Or a table with three women and one man asking the man, how much? Really? Really, you're going to characterize all three women as hookers just because that suits you? And then it took a long time to kind of wrestle it back. And then the other thing was that, unfortunately, Jonglers understood, or the marketing department understood, that selling entire packages to big parties of people was good, made good financial sense. And indeed it did. Unfortunately, it drove all the couples out of comedy clubs. And couples are the best people to play to. Yeah. Small groups of friends and couples in comedy clubs, and they don't want to sit alongside a corporate group from wherever and a stag do and all the rest of it. So Jonglers was, you know, was the victim of, I think, of those two problems. There was nothing wrong with the clubs. I had some of the best gigs I ever had at Jonglers. They were brilliant. Loved them. And audiences that you might have written off as thick, that was not my experience of them. They were smart people, including the corporate outing from Tesco and the stag do. They got it. They weren't thick. They just needed better compares.
There's a question back there. Yep. What was your pre-political
Well, at the time, I did a lot of stuff about... This was 1995, 96 when I started, and... hip hop was a big thing, and it was before rappers rapped about much. They rapped about themselves, and they rapped about rapping. I'm the number one rapper and I rap it on the scene. I wrap it up nice and I wrap it up clean, because I rap and I rap and I rap all day. Just that's all they did. Just rap about rapping and rap about themselves. I'm the best rapper that there is. If you'd say I'm not, then you are jizz. Just rubbish. And so I did a lot of stuff about rappers. And one of my favorite things was, you know, I'd love to see a rapper with low self-esteem. Just make a nice change. And then, in fact, it wasn't even a rap thing that I did, but it was... Mr. Bombastic. I used to do this again. They call me Mr. Infertile, hung like a turtle. It worked very well. It was nice. And the Oprah Winfrey Show predated, what's his name, Jerry Springer. The Oprah Winfrey Show was the go-to place for that kind of, you know, well, you know, you've slept with her sister and da-da-da and all that kind of stuff. And I characterized all of those people in those shows. Particularly, I had a penchant for large African-American women. I was able to characterize them very well, and I loved doing it. I really loved doing it, and I still look for opportunities to get it. Oprah, girlfriend, I bought my own microphone, right? And so I used to kind of do all of that, and it worked. It was great, and it was really fun. It was only that, then this is a pitfall for loads of comics. If you get a good 20, it is so hard to change it, to have the guts to bin it and move on to a new one. That's part of why I love the Edinburgh Festival, because every time I come here, I bring a brand new show, and it's the end of term and it's the beginning of term, and you bring a brand new show, and most of the material I was doing only a month or so ago, ending the Brig Society, has now gone out of my RAM in here and is in a hard drive somewhere deep in my head, and I can find it if I need to, but it's not in there. I have a new show. 20 minutes is really difficult, though. You get locked into a 20 that works. It's why so many brilliant comics, and I won't name names because these people are my friends, but they break my heart because they're stunning comedians who got stuck in a 20, a 30, and a 40 and have been unable to move themselves forward because it's too scary. And it is too, and I don't mean that to demean them at all, but to do a new 5 at the top of your 20 or your 30 or whatever, it's really hard because you don't get the same laughs, and you know it all unravels itself. It's why Edinburgh is so refreshing. It's brilliant. All the ambitious comics are coming here, and really ambitious too, because they're losing money. It takes commitment to set out your stall at this trade fair and go, "Hey everyone, this is what I made. Judge me." I love that. I love that people come and do that here. It's really impressive. And gutsy too. And it's not like heroic gutsiness, but you know, that some people might understand. But I do think it's a brave choice to make.
We'll wrap up by asking Marcus something potentially negative. How do you deal with all of those terrible gigs?
Those terrible, terrible gigs. I know, man.
Where you're coming
from. Well, I was lucky in as much as I started in 97 and there were fewer terrible gigs around, actually. I came up here in, I started in 96, actually, but sort of 97 I became professional. There was a gig up here in this very building called the Bear Pit, and it was way more scary than Leighton Live. There was a balcony behind where you performed, and if you were shite, they'd tip beer on your head. And it was the most confrontational gig, and I loved it. I loved it. A confrontational gig is brilliant. It'll give you chops. You charge on and you go, "Come on then." And they'll push back, and then you push back, and then you'll fly. What's really hard is a badly run, apathetic gig with, you know, it's hard now. There's so many comics. So people put nights on and the nights aren't really ready and there aren't enough people and the compere's not actually a pro comic with a high standard who will set things up for you in a way that as a new comic you can have a good 4 minutes out of your 7 and that's enough, right? My first gig was 7 minutes long and 4 minutes were utter shite. I had a rubber chicken in a suit, I kid you not, and I walked on stage and said I wanted to find a really strong opening, ladies and gentlemen. I pulled the rubber chicken out of my suit, put my fingers in its bottom hole and pulled it apart. I went, "That's the strongest opening I could find." Well, you laugh, they didn't. Terrible, terrible. And then all the props ran out and I started talking. And I remember at my first gig on stage thinking, if I can do this for the rest of my life, I'll be very, very happy. This is the best feeling I have ever had. And I still feel like that about this. So the really bad gigs, they just hurt. And it's as simple as that. And you either have the mettle to suck it up and go back on and have a good one, or you don't. And that's also what I love about comedy, is it's a very real and very vivid natural selection. There aren't any shit comics who've made it really big, apart from Paddy McGuinness.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Mr. Marcus Brigstocke.
So that was Marcus. I think you'll agree, that was riveting stuff. I'm so grateful to Marcus for coming on the show. Do try and see him live. And if you can't do that, then he has bundles of stuff that you can buy. And you know where this is going. You can buy it on audible.co.uk/cc. I would especially recommend God Collar, narrated by Marcus himself. It's unabridged, so 8.5 hours of his very funny search for and struggle with faith. And it absolutely eats up long drives. So remember, if you go to that address, if you're looking for God Collar, go to audible.co.uk/cc and you can get the audiobook free when you sign up to a trial membership. And you'll also be helping out the podcast as well. Thanks to Marcus. Thanks to Pete Jones, James Lowy, BLC. This show was co-produced by Nathan Wood. Thanks to you for listening. Donate if you like, share if you prefer. Next week is going to be incredible. Speak to you soon. P.S. It's Tony Law. It's so good.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.